the last time you cried? Are you a sobber, a crybaby, or does it take a lot for you to tear up? This is The Body Sphere on RN Summer. I'm Amanda Smith. So what's crying for, and what's the origin of human tears? Now, given that crying is quite an extreme response, you know, it's pretty hard to ignore someone who's crying, the more you think about it, the more it seems curious that there are so many states that make you cry.
It is extraordinary. It's one of the mysteries of tears, that they can express almost anything.
Thomas Dixon is the director of the Centre for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University, London.
Not just a very wide range of emotions, from grief and sadness to joy and ecstasy, with other thrown into, like fear, frustration, rage, but also states that aren't emotions at all, such as sensations of pain or thoughts, kind of melancholy or sentimental thoughts, which aren't really emotions. They don't get you upset, but might have a tear trickling down your cheek. So there's a huge range of mental states that produce tears. So if you just see a tear on somebody's cheek and you don't know anything else, and maybe you can't even see the rest of their face, that could mean absolutely anything of all those things I've just listed. They might be chopping an onion, they might have just yawned, they might have just been sick, or they might just got married.
The last time I cried because I slammed my thumb in the car door, and I came inside the house and I curled up in a fetal position on the floor in the lounge room and sobbed. I mean, shouting would make more sense. Swearing would make more sense. But to cry when you slam your thumb in the door is a very peculiar reaction, and I think it must be tears of stupidity.
I remember crying at the end of Toy Story 3, and that was mainly just because Andy was the same age as me in the 90s when the first two films came out. I didn't cry during those two films, but when I saw this one, I was 20, and he was 20, that period of change, and when Andy has to pass on his toys, you know, that was representative of me in this exact point in time that I'm in. I sort of saw it as a culmination of my childhood in this movie.
Grief makes me cry. The long-haul grief of loved ones, my dad or my sister, who died some years ago now. So I'll just be walking along the street and suddenly cry, missing my sister or my dad. It's a release. I don't cry for very long, and it makes me feel closer to them, actually. So I don't know whether it really is grief at all, but it makes me cry.
But why this particular physiological reaction to all these possible states? What did Charles Darwin have to say about tears?
Darwin thought a lot about this. One of his most popular books was published in 1872, and it's called The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. It was quite a hit amongst Victorian readers, a kind of coffee table book. One of the first books to include photographic illustrations showing animals and babies crying and all sorts of different emotional expressions. So he thought about this a lot. And his theory is interesting in that it ignores what we think is the most obvious thing, which is the communicative power of weeping, the idea that tears are part of a natural language in which we understand each other's feelings. That wasn't really his interest. He was interested in the physiology of muscles around the eyes and the kind of more technical physiological question of how did this mechanism get set up. So anyway, his basic theory was, in our evolutionary past, infants, when they screamed very loudly because they're upset or they wanted their mum, would close their eyes very tightly to protect their eyes when they were screaming, and the closing of the eyes very tightly would squeeze the lacrimal glands and bring out the tears. And then by process of association thereafter, any kind of pain or suffering got associated with tears. That's his basic theory.
But he also then goes on to see weeping tears as having no modern adaptive purpose.
Yeah. So for Darwin, weeping is very much not adaptive. We might expect him, as a great evolutionist, to explain it in terms of the adaptive advantage, but he doesn't. For him, weeping is a pretty purposeless side effect of other things. So an infant screaming for its mother is adaptive, potentially, if it means the mother goes and picks up the infant and takes care of it. But the tears squeezed out of the infant's eyes, for Darwin, are a mere side effect of no real purpose. And the Victorian poet Tennyson had a similar thought when he wrote about tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean.
Well, someone who says that tears are more than simply idle is Ad Finkelholz. He's one of the few modern scientists to study tears, and he's the author of Why Only Humans Weep, Unraveling the Mysteries of Tears, and he's from the University of Tilburg in the Netherlands. So why is surprisingly little known about why human adults weep?
We simply are not aware that crying is a behavior rather than a symptom. We are most considered a symptom of sadness. And scientists generally are not interested in symptoms. We do not study butterflies in the stomach, but we are interested in love. And we do not study trembling knees, but we are interested in fear. So why would we study tears? But they don't realize that producing emotional tears, that's a real behavior. That's very important.
Well, we'll talk more about that. But are humans the only species to actually weep?
Yes. In the sense of producing emotional tears, we are the only species. But producing distress calls or separation calls, that's a property of all mammals. If you separate offspring from the mothers, you hear that they start making some noise.
So what's the difference?
The difference is that animals produce only noise. No tears.
There is, though, the expression crocodile tears, isn't there? Crying crocodile tears, the idea of making a display of crying without any real emotion behind the tears. Do crocodiles actually produce a flow of tears?
It has been observed that they produce tears when they eat, and that may have to do with the fact that helps their digestion.
Right. But it's not because they're sad.
No, definitely not.
Well, this business of it being only humans who cry emotionally, as Ad Finkelholz says, there are people who maintain that gorillas, camels, their dogs weep. Thomas Dixon.
Yeah, the consensus scientific view of these hard-hearted scientists is that animals do not weep emotionally. That's been the sort of scientific consensus for some decades. But Darwin thought that animals could weep emotionally. He cited a macaque monkey in London Zoo that could do it, and he also firmly believed that Indian elephants could do it, that when they were captured or distressed or dying that they would weep in grief. It's not just their eyes would water, that they were crying. And going back further, horses, dogs, crocodiles, deer, turtles, camels you mentioned, occasionally cattle looking. Everyone agrees that animals can produce tears out of their eyes for whatever physiological purpose. But historically, people have believed often that they can cry as well.
Not so much now.
No, now that is not the standard view. So Darwin is a bit of an embarrassment for modern psychologists in that he was more willing to ascribe human emotions to animals than scientists tend to be today. There is also, I should say, a long history of the opposite view that only humans weep. So, you know, there's been this debate going on for centuries. And certainly as far back as the 16th and 17th century, there were some who said it's only humans who can weep. Animals can't. And the reasons why they can't are really interesting. Animals can't because they don't have the intellectual capacity to have the kind of complex emotional representations of the world that lie behind crying.
But if you go to the Bodysphere website, you'll see there in the comments section a story from a listener in WA who's convinced that animals, in his case birds, can weep. Have a look at it. It's actually a beautiful story. However, sticking with human crying, and this is the Bodysphere on RN, Amanda Smith with you, Ad Fingerhoots defines crying as a human behaviour because, for example, it shows developmental changes with age.
First is that with increasing age, the noise, so the acoustic aspects of crying, becomes less important and the visible tears become more important. That's one thing. Another thing is that with increasing age, you see the development of the gender differential. So adult women cry more often than adult men, but that's not the case in newborns. And what's important is that there are developments in the reasons why people cry. Powerlessness and being separated from loved ones, that stays important all over the lifespan. But, for example, physical pain, which is very important for infants and until adolescence, for adults, it's not really important. On the other hand, what is important for adults is what we call sentimental tearing, so crying because we see others doing good to other people, self-sacrifice, that kind of things. And of course, together with our increasing capacity of empathy, we also start crying more, not only because of our own distress, but also because of the distress and suffering of others.
What about cultural or historical differences? According to Thomas Dixon, who's looked at this particularly in relation to Britain, crying is very much influenced by time and place.
If you go back to the time of Shakespeare, both on the stage and in real life, weeping was much more common, much more free-flowing, much more exuberant and extreme. So it's certainly not always been the case that the British had a stiff upper lip. And that's one example of how culture changes the ways our bodies behave. So you could go to many different countries in the world. There's been footage of people weeping over the deaths of leaders in North Korea, for example, which is commented on in the West, that this seems kind of staged or very theatrical. But we all have our different ways of staging and performing our tears. In England, we do it at football matches, for example. So it's both a universal physiological response, but also highly sensitive to cultural difference.
Well, historically, it's interesting the observations that have been made about tears. For example, in the 19th century, British scientists sometimes attribute crying to be more prevalent among what they call primitive societies. Then others go the opposite way and say that tears are more commonly found in highly civilised societies.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably amongst your listeners, there are some people who think of themselves as weepers and other people who are more stoical and reserved and pour scorn on people who are easily moved to tears. And both those groups have always been around, and there have been scientific theories to back them both up. So, as you say, in the 19th century, there are some people like Darwin, who we've already mentioned, who thought that not crying was a sign of civilisation. And of course, for Darwin, the pinnacle of civilisation was the English gentleman. So he says, the Englishman rarely cries, unlike people he called savages, who would weep very copiously at a slight cause. So for Darwin, there's this kind of racial and racist hierarchy with the reserved, non-weeping white man at the top. And as you say, there's also the reverse theory, which is that savages, as they were called, didn't have the intellectual capacity to have those very refined moral feelings that would give rise to tears. So there's then the reverse theory that not crying is primitive and uncivilized. So you've got scientific arguments on both sides.
Well, what's certainly observable to me anyway in my own lifetime is that it's become more acceptable to cry in this country as well as yours, I think. I mean, there was that tremendous outpouring of mass tears in the UK when Princess Diana died, and we do seem to be more emotionally expressive these days. Would you say that's true?
Definitely. I mean, I've noticed it during my lifetime as well. And if you look on, you know, social networking sites and Facebook in particular, amongst, you know, younger friends and relatives, they're overflowing with kisses and effusive statements of love and emotion, and it's a completely different register from one that I grew up with. And certainly, yes, if you look at public life as well, I mean, well before 1997, when Diana died, there'd been a major shift in British culture and public life. Everyone was being repeatedly told, it's great to cry, it's great to show your emotions, it's healthy, it's natural. This was the mantra which saturated the sort of second half of the 20th century, this new form of confessional and tearful public performance, which would have been absolutely anathema to our grandparents.
Well, that's really the demise of the British stiff upper lip. But what gave rise to that stiff upper lip?
That is one of the main questions that has motivated my research, actually, as a victim of the British stiff upper lip myself. You know, I wanted to find out, where has this come from? And there are a couple of answers. Going right back to the Reformation, the Protestant reaction against Catholicism, part of that was a reaction against an overly emotional and sensual and tearful kind of religion. And so the Protestant spirit is obviously much more austere. So any country that has been through that process will have in its DNA, if you like, that Protestant austerity and reserve. Then in the case of Britain, there's the effects of the French Revolution. After the French Revolution, it became normal to think of the French as kind of dangerously passionate and revolting in all senses, and the British as more contained. Brits were not the kind of people who had revolutions. And then finally, the main factor then is the rise of the British Empire from the late 19th century onwards through the period of two world wars. In effect, British culture is militarised, and the kind of discipline that is appropriate to a public school boy or to a soldier becomes generally dispersed for this nation that is attempting to rule the world and therefore needs to rule its own heart very severely. So I think those are the main factors that result in Britain becoming known for having this so-called stiff upper lip, which is the title of a Gershwin song from 1937, which just about sums it all up.
Stiff upper lip, stout fella, carry on old fluff, chin up, keep muddling through. Stiff upper lip, stout fellow, when the going's rough.
Stout fellow. Now, Aunt Finkelholz mentioned gender differences earlier with adult crying, so what are they?
Yeah, there are differences not only in the frequency of crying between men and women, but also in the reasons. So loss situation, there's hardly any difference between men and women, but the difference is especially observable in conflict situations. Women cry more often when they experience, so to say, a kind of powerless anger.
When I'm really upset, I usually just become very quiet and sullen. But when I'm really mad, I cry. That's when I cry, and I will cry buckets when I'm furious. Arguments with me always end in tears, even when they're about nothing, even when they're about why don't you clean up the kitchen or any other silly argument. I don't know any different, but I know certainly to my partner that he finds it a real frustration because he feels like every time we have an argument about anything, I'll start crying. And he says, please don't cry. I can't watch you when you cry. And you know you're going to win. You're using this. And I'm like, I'm not using it. I don't know why it's like this, but it just is.
And men relatively cry more often for, so to say, positive reasons. So for tender feelings.
I don't cry very much at all. But when I do, I find that it opens up feelings that I may have suppressed previously. Something that comes to mind is the first time I really connected with my niece, and she was about 1.5 years old, and I'd never met her before in person. And when I did, we connected. And it wasn't until after I travelled back from visiting her, and yeah, as soon as I arrived home, I literally, for some reason, just couldn't control my emotions and cried. And I surprised myself, but it felt quite liberating for somebody that doesn't really cry a lot. Yeah.
It's very surprising for most people. So women cry more often in Western culture than men do. And whereas often people feel that it has to do with the female hormone, I think that it's more the male hormone, testosterone, which has an inhibitory influence on crying. And then, of course, social learning. Until now, it's often the case that when a boy cries, that he said that he should be strong and so on. And it's not only the influence of the parents, but especially also of the peers, which is very important.
Yeah, you don't want to be a crybaby.
Yeah.
This is a story when I didn't cry. I wanted to cry, but I didn't. So when I was about 9, and I had a bike, and this one other kid dared me to a race down the big hill. And we were almost at the bottom of the hill, and a little girl on her bike was coming across the intersection, and I completely T-boned her. I skidded along the road, on the gravel road, burns and gravel rash up the side of my body and up my arms, and I got up and I was going, and I looked around and I saw the little girl just get up, pick her bike up, and get on it and ride away. And I just sat there going, no! But I didn't cry.
And in the body sphere, this is a cultural history of crying. Now, adult weeping in relation to the suffering of others has a long religious history. Thomas Dixon.
The thing that I suppose most surprised me when I started researching this topic, looking for tears in history, is that time and again I was brought back to religious contexts. So one of the most famous and prolific English weepers is a 15th century mystic called Marjorie Kemp. And we have her autobiographical book, which is the most tear-soaked autobiography you will ever read. She is an extreme weeper. And for her, it's a religious act. It's an act of penance, of compunction, to use her word, so of penitence about sin, and also of compassion with the suffering of others, and especially the suffering of Christ. So broadly speaking, in medieval Catholicism, weeping is not only a religious act, but a religious duty to show that one is connected to the suffering and compassion at the center of the Christian religion.
There's a line in one of the Psalms of David, "You have stored my tears in your bottle and counted each of them." And there is a tradition of tear bottles in early Western cultures, pagan as well as Christian, but did people really collect tears? Aunt Finkelholz.
Yeah, tear bottles have been found in ancient Egyptian Greek societies, also in Rome. And first it was thought that these bottles were used to collect tears. But now it has been doubted, this thing that these vessels contained ritual oils and perfumes. But what we know for sure is that tear bottles have been used by sailors and soldiers when they were separated from their loved ones. Also more recently, in the 19th century, they have been used when those mourning the loss of their loved ones collected their tears. And the mourning period was ended when the tears had evaporated from the bottle.
There's also in the Vatican something called the Room of Tears.
Yeah, the Room of Tears is the room where newly elected popes go to be dressed for their first presentation to the world. And, well, it appears that many of these newly elected popes burst into tears when they entered this room. The mixture of positive and negative emotions that they experienced when they became aware of the great responsibility that they held and the enormous burden by this new office.
Sometimes tears come from an imagined loss.
This was the worst time. It was in year 10 English class. We watched a movie called The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Have you seen that? About two Irish brothers fighting on different sides of the thing. And it was a great movie. And right now, as I talk about it, I'm probably going to tear up because every time I think about this, it happens again. At the very end of the movie, one brother is forced to kill his brother essentially because he won't come over to the other side. And I have such a close relationship with my brother. And I didn't see this coming. And they're both like so upset and wrecked about it. And I'm in a classroom and I am actually crying. Like I'm sitting on the back and tears are coming out of my face. And it's the end of the movie. Turn on the lights. And I hid pretty much. It was so powerful. And even now, as I talk about it, I well up.
The last time I cried was a few hours ago on a plane watching an in-flight movie because movies make me cry all the time and usually movies that I'm not even really liking. And I can see the bit coming up where they're going to make you cry and I go, that's so manipulative, and then I cry. And it's just like tears flood down my face. I don't know why I'm so susceptible, but that's it, movies, every time.
It's always been the case that drama in particular, stage plays, going back to classical antiquity, have been a vehicle for this very focused expression of emotion, this very highly dramatized form of expression. And when the novel was invented as a literary form in the 18th century, again, it was very normal to read a novel and to weep. I think, in essence, one of the main things that makes us cry is a story. a story with a structure and an unfolding narrative with moments of perhaps unexpected tragedy or perhaps longed for resolution. A story is crafted in a way that gives us that. It's designed specifically to tap into the way that we think and feel, which is presented in a form that isn't as messy and complicated and confused as our normal everyday lives are. But it's certainly a curious phenomenon, because what a lot of people will say is, why are you crying over that film? You know, these people aren't real. This didn't happen. These are actors. So again, people tend to divide on that point. You know, some people like me will sit on the sofa happily weeping over a movie, and other people who are determined not to be manipulated in that way.
Yes, well, I did want to ask, what's guaranteed to make tears roll down your cheeks?
Well, I guess the short answer is almost anything. And that's one of the reasons I got interested in this myself. Well, actually, I was required to weep on air for a documentary program that I made, so I had to think, how am I going to do this? And the way that I achieved it, which is something I knew would work, was to read out loud some of the children's stories of Oscar Wilde, so The Happy Prince and The Selfish Giant. And that's another, I think, really interesting phenomenon that other people may have experienced, that there's something about saying something out loud, the public making heard of your story, that brings tears and gets you choked up, whereas if you were sitting there quietly, you wouldn't be weeping. And I think that shows us how tears are a social phenomenon. It's something we do in public, it's a kind of performance, it's showing other people what's going through our head.
And yet there are also moments when you cry because you're alone. I mean, I can think of times where I wouldn't have let myself cry if anyone else had been around, but because no one was around, I could.
Yeah, and that's another of the complexities of crying. I would stand by the idea that if we can say anything about a general theory of tears, I think it would have to involve their social nature, the fact it's something that we do in relation to other people. But, like many social activities, like, I don't know, another example, say having sex, it's something you can do on your own. It's not the normal or primary way of doing it, but you can. And humans are such infinitely complex creatures that we have the ability to take what is a social activity, but find our own way of doing it in private. And I think that does apply to crying as well. And for those who are religious, both in the present and historically, there's always an audience, potentially, which is God, and that's certainly the case in the religious traditions of people weeping privately when praying, and they're weeping in front of God. But even for those who think they really are just weeping for nobody apart from themselves, it's still a sort of performance. You're showing yourself things have really got bad, or whatever it may be.
Thomas Dixon is the director of the Centre for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London. You also heard from Art Finkerhoutz from the School of Social and Behavioural Sciences at the University of Tilburg in the Netherlands, and the author of Why Only Humans Weep. And thanks also to all those who told me their crying stories. I'm Amanda Smith. You can download or stream this program from the Bodysphere website, which is where you can post a comment if you feel so moved. abc.net.au/radionational.